Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is your co-host, Joe Hagan. I am here with my co-host, Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever this is finding you.
Yes, whatever part of the world you are in. Today, we have a insightful interview with a Vanity Fair contributor, Mei Jiang, who is going to talk to us about the uprising in China. She herself is a Korean from Canada, but she spent a month in China for this magazine 2 years ago writing about a pop star in China who was basically disappeared by the Chinese government. And she went looking for that pop star and learned a lot about China, has a lot of sources there, and can talk to us a lot about what China was like before these protests erupted over the zero COVID policy. Obviously, kind of like what we saw in Iran and what we have seen elsewhere. You know, you have these repressive regimes. There's like a lot going on under the surface. People are getting a lot of propaganda and suddenly everything blows. And what we knew before, you know, suddenly has changed and all bets are off. So that's what we talk about with Mei. She's an award-winning investigative journalist. She's got a lot of amazing insights, and we're happy to have her on Inside the Hive. Before we go to her, we're going to go to our other hard-hitting investigative reporter, Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
Welcome to Inside the Hive.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy that we have her on and that we're talking about this because it feels like the kind of story we should be talking about that sometimes could get swallowed up in the shenanigans of U.S. politics. And I think that that's the point of a lot of these kooky people who have been running for office over the last 5 years is they want to suck up all the oxygen in the room, and then we don't get to talk about all the actually important, nuanced, oniony things that are happening around the globe, and I'm really glad that we do. Before we talk about some of the kooky things, and I think we should, don't you just feel like with what's happening in China, with what's happening in Iran, and then what's happening around the country, it feels like things are topsy-turvy. Have you been following this whole Balenciaga scandal? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Bring me up to speed.
Okay. So Balenciaga, the fashion house, put out two ads that were in an unrelated campaigns. The first ad featured children who were holding stuffed animals who were dressed up in BDSM wear.
Right, I did see this, yes.
Second ad featured what looked like a messy office, and sleuths on the internet somehow thought to zoom in, and they were printouts of a Supreme Court case that had to do with child pornography. And that we're even having this conversation is so beyond weird. I have no idea what happened to make it so. I do know that generally speaking, when you're putting out a big thing, there are a lot of people who have to weigh in on those decisions. I think that there are a lot of people who approve of things. There doesn't seem to be a ton of accidents that happen in particularly two separate photo campaigns that were likely approved by layers and layers and layers of people. And then that's coupled with Kanye West doing what Kanye West is doing and then bringing that to Donald Trump, who is a candidate for president in the Republican Party. And it just feels like everything's topsy-turvy. And what is this world coming to, and what are our values, and are we getting sucked into a Black Mirror episode?
Well, that's what I was about to say, Twin Peaks, just to show my my vintage references.
Sure.
But it does seem like Donald Trump has taught the world that you can play the edge and that actually that might actually help you marketing-wise.
Mm.
Right? He's going to pretend that he didn't know that there was a white supremacist at his dinner table sitting there with an anti-Semite, another anti-Semite, Kanye West. It's obviously atrocious. We pay attention to it, probably too much. Was it an accidental or was it a canny way to get people's attention because he's desperate for attention as usual? But then I also had to think to myself, don't you have a daughter who converted to Judaism and a Jewish son-in-law who maybe you care about, but then you're going to bring these rabid, well-known, well-advertised anti-Semites to your own dinner table? It just feels...
He has grandchildren who are Jewish, right? He has three grandchildren who are Jewish. He has a daughter who's now Jewish, and No, he doesn't care about them. It's the reality.
Just to clear that up right off
yes,
the top.
Yes, I think that that's the answer. That's the answer. Do you want to talk about that family?
Let's talk about that family. You have written a story in the, I'm going to say, the latest issue of Vanity Fair.
No, it is online now. It will be in print in February. Slightly different, but, you
that's
know,
okay.
the general.
Yeah, it gives it a longer shelf life. You can read it online, then it's going to come in your mailbox in a glossy, beautifully photographed form.
Honestly, the spread is kind of iconic looking. The way it is laid out in the magazine, our fantastic editors and photo team have done what really looks like a classic Vanity Fair magazine spread for this story. They did A+ work on it.
Well, it's a very juicy, very insightful and well written piece called Inside Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner's Gilded Florida Paradise, Far from Donald Trump or 2024. Now we know why, how far they would like to get, I can well imagine in this moment. But I've been hearing about this behind the scenes, of course, because I have special access to Emily Jane Fox's, behind
brain.
The scenes. Yes, brain, basically your brain. And I just want to know what it was like for you right off the bat. I just want to ask you this very sort of, frontline gossip question.
Mm.
What's it like to you went into their abode. Did you go into Jared and Ivanka's home?
I feel very confident in describing the way I described the home.
Yes.
I feel like I got a real look at their world. I'll put it that way. I feel very confident in the way I described it. Here's what I will say. I have been writing and reporting about them, on them for, I don't know, what year is it? It's about to be 2023. I've been writing about them since 2015. So almost 8 years, my entirety of my career at Vanity Fair, I've been writing about them. You know, it's interesting. I got a mean tweet yesterday about the article saying, like, you're blowing smoke up their ass. And it's funny. As I was writing this story, I had a feeling that there would maybe be some blowback that I'm writing about, that their life is good right now, that they are actually like happier than they've ever been, or certainly since I've been reporting on them, that they have not really been tainted by Donald Trump and their association, that they've been able to make a ton of money, live a life that is as out of the spotlight as they could ever wish to be. They've made new friends. They're not spit on in the street. They're not cursed by ladies with canes waving them in the air in Miami. And I think a lot of people in this country understandably want them to have the opposite of that. It is not my job as a journalist to make their life bad, right? And I understand why people want their life to not be gilded as it is. I understand they were part of an administration and party to all the things that administration did in a way that doesn't feel befitting of a peaceful life. I completely understand that. But our job as journalists is to just report the facts as they are. And the reality of their situation is that they are happier, richer, and more at peace than ever. And that is a function of the fact that there are a lot of people in Florida who think of them as heroes, that they did exactly what they wanted them to do. They lowered taxes for them. They kept restaurants open for them during COVID, which was a boon to people personally and restaurant proprietors. And people in Florida moved to Florida from major cities in order to save money. And I think that those are the kinds of people who would welcome the Kushners with open arms.
Well, okay. So two things I want to say right off the top. The wonderful thing about this story is it's not trying to be an op-ed. It is a work of journalism, a very beautifully constructed work of journalism. And your reaction is not to Emily Jane Fox. It's to what you're reading.
Yes.
And that's the point of it, right? It's there laid out in black and white for you to judge as you will, right? Which is what's great about it. The other thing is they went to Florida to avoid what they might get on the streets of Manhattan, which is, heaps of abuse. We saw how people voted in this last midterm for DeSantis. I wrote about Florida a year ago when I went there and spent some time, and people, they have an idea of what freedom means for them, and that's why they're going there. And a lot of money traveled from New York down there, and the Kushners is part of that, and they're living on Julio Iglesias's island, or about to, right? They're building this fortress of happiness where they can watch Game of Thrones on Friday night. And, you know, they're just like every other everyday couple who gets together and watch their Netflix on Friday night, except for the billions of Saudi dollars sitting in their investment funds. But that's, you know, neither here nor there.
Sure. Sure. It's a fascinating term for me. I wrote a story in, I don't know what it was, maybe it was the February issue or January issue of our magazine 2 years ago. And it basically posed the question of what would their life be like in Florida? And it was a lot of people who were very, I would say they are key players, people who know them, people who know their social circles very, very well, opining about what their life would be like. And the consensus was that they would be ostracized, that the world would never exist to them the way it did. And that story was an incredibly popular story. It was widely read, widely shared. I think that the fact that the idea of them being completely, I believe that the headline of the story was MAGA non grata, and that they would just be completely invisible was very appealing to many people. And I understand why that was the case. And so I wanted to follow up and see if that was in fact true. And I think that my conclusion is to their old circle of people in the places, the events that they used to go to, the people they used to socialize with, the kinds of circles they used to travel in Manhattan, at the Met Ball, in the Hamptons, on the yachts in the Adriatic, they are still MAGA non grata. They will never be invited back in those circles. And at the same time, I believe there is a sentiment in Kushner world that they are beyond those circles, that once you're in the Situation Room and negotiating the Abraham Accord, who the fuck cares about going to the Met Ball, right? Like,
they're next level, man. They don't need that old, that dirty old town.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And part of that, I think, is true. Part of that is self-preservation, like, oh, you're not inviting me to your thing. I'm too good for your thing anyway, right? Like, everyone has had that moment in middle school. You're like, I'm not invited to the party. Like, screw you. Like, I'm better than your party, right? That's kind of the attitude a little bit. And some of that is true and some of that is delusion. That's where they are. And I think they are happily, I believe, look, I never say never. And if you were to tell me tomorrow Jared Kushner's back running the campaign, I would say, okay. Like,
there they go again.
There they go again. They left a really nice life before all of this to go into this in 2015, right? Like, they already made this decision once before. My deep understanding of where they are mentally is like, what is the point? Like, they feel like they have accomplished all the things that they wanted to accomplish. And in a way, having a $3 billion fund that was largely funded by a relationship that he made in the White House, whether or not you believe that is corrupt or crooked or ethically ambiguous or whatever you think that that is what happened. And so what else is there to do? Why go back?
Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Well, let's also point out one really interesting aspect of this, which is Ivanka's decision not to involve herself in her father's next campaign.
And publicly state that she is not involving herself.
Right, which I immediately took as there's no way he can win and they know it and they want nothing to do with him. But also because they've already been tainted and compromised by their association with him. And this, I think this Kanye, Nick Fuentes thing underlines, italicizes, and otherwise highlights why they should run as far as they can. I don't know if they can be, like you said, in Florida, they'll always be able to walk the streets and no problem. But in the long historical view, there is no escape from the historical taint. I will judge them from afar as a reader of your article.
Well, everyone will. I mean, you know, I had the urge yesterday to pick up my phone and be like, what did you think of him having dinner? And I just like, I didn't, because ultimately I don't care. Like,
yeah,
the reality of their relationship, and I have asked that question of them many, 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 many times. I asked it around Charlottesville. I asked around all the incendiary, inflammatory, anti-Semitic, bigoted things that Donald Trump did in office. I asked the question, like, what are you saying behind the scenes? What are you saying publicly? Like, what is your reaction to this? If you're going to be there and you are saying that we're basically the adults in the room, what is your adult opinion? And how are you expressing that to the most powerful man in the country? And kind of every time I asked that question, I was annoyed at myself, because like, either they're saying nothing or it doesn't matter. So I don't really care, because either they're saying nothing or what they're saying doesn't matter and he's going to do what he wants to do anyway. There's something that I've been noodling about since writing this and while I was writing this, definitely. There's definitely a gendered thing here where, you know, for her whole life, Ivanka was this like bright, shiny star, right? She was beautiful and she was Ivy League educated and she was the sibling who was chosen to be on The Apprentice. And then in the White House, and she was the one who was really campaigning for him. And her father talked about her that way. Her husband talked about her that way. And Jared was very much behind the scenes. He didn't really do any interviews. He didn't do any campaigning. And it has switched now, right? Jared came out with a book that was a best-selling book this summer. He did a full press tour, albeit only with conservative media. He's the one who raised $3 billion and started a fund. He's been definitely more public, more social, more out there. And Ivanka doesn't have a day job anymore, right? She's not. She's focusing on being a mom, and that's completely admirable.
Surfing.
But she's learning to surf. She's learning breathing techniques. Yes, which honestly we could all use. But it's a real reversal in their marriage. A real reversal in their fortunes, I would say. And yet, Jared Kushner is at the announcement at Mar-a-Lago. Ivanka Trump is not at the announcement at Mar-a-Lago. She puts out a statement saying, I want nothing to do with it. And that is covered. And so I think that there is like this expectation that her life should be ruined and that she needs to stay far away from it for her reputation. And yet he's like walking around all over town coming off like nothing's ever happened. And I think, obviously, yes, she's his daughter, but he was a closer advisor in the White House maybe than she was, maybe possibly more senior, more involved in more things. And yet he has walked away cleaner than she has. And I have to think maybe that's a gender thing. I don't know. I think yeah. They're both doing just fine. And that is a money thing more than anything.
Right. Well, two things I'll say to conclude here. Well, three things. First, go read this article. If you're out there listening to Inside the Hive, you care about all things hive-ish, then you must therefore read this story about Ivanka by Emily Jane Fox. It is, you will have opinions and feelings one way or the other, and it's fun.
If you ever thought about Jared and Ivanka and what their life would be like right now, it is, I'm telling you, this is what their life is like right now.
Yes, this is the inside.
Every dirty detail.
Dope. Every dirty deal. And all these weird relationships they have and all the characters in their orbit and what that world looks like nowadays. Second thing I want to say is there was an op-ed in the Times about saying, you know, we should ignore Donald Trump. And when I read that op-ed, which you should also go check out, I totally agreed with it and think that we should no longer talk about that former. The less we talk about the former president, the better it off we all are. And okay, end of that discussion. But third, I just would like to think about, you know, they're both wearing Kabbalah beads now, you mentioned,
around their
wrists, right?
Yeah.
So they're doing some deep breathing and some meditation. And there's a line in your story, I would love it if they would meditate on. Maybe they can just, when they're closing their eyes and they've got their, you know, cross-legged on a soft pillow, looking out at the Miami horizon out of their $24 million mansion or whatever. They can think of this line about Jared's close personal relationship with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Even after U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that MBS had approved the 2018 killing and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, after which he made this $1.2 billion deal. I hope he'll meditate on Jamal Khashoggi because, as we know, he was tortured and dismembered with a bone saw at the behest of MBS. So, this money that's sitting in this fund and the billions that are financing this beautiful lifestyle, it comes with a big asterisk. And, the average person, you or me, Emily Jane Fox, sure, I'll take $1 billion. I'll take $1.2 billion. But would I take it from him? I don't think so. That's like an ethical decision to make that. And I think the way that Jared sees the world is this. He thinks he can be in a kind of a real politic kind of world in which, you scratch my back, I scratch yours, I'll look the other way because you're, working on my benefit, and I'm going to solve Middle East peace because of this relationship. And oh, by the way, I'm getting super rich off of it. I don't know. There's a certain kind of person that can live with that. And I find it to be kind of questionable and worthy of examination. And I'm glad that you made a fine point of it in your story.
Well, let me just end on one thing, and let me just possibly explain the psychology.
Yes, right? Please.
They have both been compartmentalizing and making excuses for bad men their entire lives, right? Their fathers, and we know who her father is. In case you don't know who his father is, went to prison for a number of different fraud counts, but one count of witness tampering because he thought that his sister and brother-in-law were cooperating with this investigation led by then Attorney General of New Jersey, Chris Christie. And in order to get them to not cooperate in this investigation, he set his brother-in-law up with a prostitute, hid a camera in the room of a motel where this encounter was occurring, took the tape and sent it to his sister. And Jared went to visit his dad every weekend in jail when he was a college student at Harvard. He thinks that his father is simply the best man. And so these are two people. And by the way, their fathers are both incredibly rich and for a long time were their meal tickets and their bosses. And so they have been making excuses and compartmentalizing the bad things of bad men who could then financially serve them for their entire existences. So the fact that he can compartmentalize what MBS has done is no surprise to me because that's a muscle he's been exercising for decades.
Yeah. These are really just wonderful people, aren't they?
Yeah. That's my little therapizing to help people who potentially can't understand because it's not something that you or I or our listeners could ever do. That is, I think, what must be happening in the brains. Take that and do what you want with it.
Put it in your pipe and smoke it, as they say.
Exactly. Well, we will get into our very, very fascinating interview on a very, very important topic. And honestly, maybe this is like the last episode of the year that we talk about the Trumps.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make a moratorium on all
no
things
Trump December.
That guy.
No Trump
yeah,
December.
No Trump. Oh, I like that. I like that. So no Trump December. We've arrived. Welcome. I've even already forgot what I just said and who I was talking about.
Well, sayonara.
Emily Jane Fox, it's always a delight.
A pleasure. Listen to the interview, and we will see you on the other side.
And now I'd like to welcome Mei Zhang, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, her first time on Inside the Hive. Thanks, Mei, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You have written some fantastic pieces for Vanity Fair, and you're an award-winning investigative journalist. We're really proud to have you on here today. And your name sprang up in editorial brain trust here at Vanity Fair when we were thinking about who could tell us about what's going on in China. It's all over the headlines, and you know, there's a lot of that I get about it, but a lot I don't understand about it, and that's why we'd like you to help us kind of gloss the whole thing today. So, you know, tell me a little bit about your own background, since you're, you know, a reporter at Vanity Fair. People may have seen your byline. The last one you did was about a story in the spring about some shootings in Atlanta and some Asian American victims and what the ramifications of it were. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about your background first.
Sure. I live in Brooklyn, and I've been here for about 5 years. Prior to that, I used to live in Kabul, Afghanistan, where I was reporting on, I guess, the ongoing war there, specifically civilian casualties issues. And the story that took me to China for the first time was in 2018, when this megastar in China called Fan Bingbing, she's really a household name. It's very difficult to find people in the Chinese film industry, for example, who hasn't worked with her in one way or another. And she disappeared out of the blue, and I was sent there to find her in an act of perhaps hubris or some misguided devotion to, you know, the power of investigative journalism. And yeah, I spent about a month there looking for her. And the story that comes out is, it took me to very unlikely places. And what was most fascinating to me about my time there was just thinking about the ways in which I think Americans specifically, and I'm not American, I'm from Canada and my family's from Korea, but there is this tendency to always think about global events within, through the prism of America. And actually, it's kind of interesting to have that assumption challenged. And it was kind of exciting for me to think about the ways in which other people live elsewhere. And it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, it's not a commentary on whether American politics is, you know, good or bad. And that's something that I've been thinking about a lot in the last couple of days as well with the protests.
Yeah. Tell me what you mean by that, like your expectations for what freedom should look like or democracy should look like are, you know, you can't necessarily apply them when you are going to report on China. Yeah.
Sure. I suppose what I mean is that China is one of those issue areas, I'm using air quotes, that is often appropriated to advance an argument in America. And sometimes, you know, with the right, it could be an argument in favor of whatever, you know, capitalism or, you know, less state control or what have you. And at times, like, the same thing happens in the left as well. And specifically with regards to responses to the most recent COVID pandemic, I think I've just noticed a lot of rhetoric around, and you know, there are these like memes about as well on the internet about how, you know, everywhere else in the world, people are, you know, protesting to strike and you know, not, you know, and then in China, people are actually protesting so that they can go back to work and return to normal life. But I think that's it's a funny haha comment, but also it's equally not entirely helpful, you know, just because the policies and the state response and state violence really in China has been so brutal doesn't necessarily need to be what is called an endorsement of the ways in which, you know, this country has dealt with the pandemic. It's been equally terrible.
Certainly
and
not.
Tens of thousands have died here as well. And sure. I think that's kind of the pitfall that I'm always interested in avoiding or trying to at least.
Right. And there was plenty of ignorance and misinformation in this country that, as we know, drove a lot of casualties, death, you know, in addition to conspiracy theories about China being the origin of the virus to begin with and some kind of nefarious thing. We won't get sidetracked on that. But in this case, I think this whole event that we're seeing in the last week, these uprisings that are around the country in various places, it was sparked by the death of 10 people in a fire in a northwest province of Xinjiang. And the rescue efforts were allegedly hampered because of the COVID lockdown. people were infuriated, angered by this, and it spread around the country. And obviously, this had been boiling underneath the surface, right? And this was a flashpoint. Tell me a little bit about what life was like in China before this. I mean, we all know from living just in the U.S. during the pandemic, it can be maddening, you know, being trapped at home, especially as long as they have, there's something can create desperation. Let's put it that way. So tell me a little bit about what the zero policy, you know, zero COVID policy was like.
Sure. I don't know where you were during the plague, but when it came for us, I was in New York in Brooklyn. And the first couple of weeks, if you remember, I mean, we really didn't know what was the cause. And so then everyone was kind of, you know, like wiping down vegetables and, you know, all sorts of things. And I guess it's imagine sort of that suspended sense of disbelief and living in that liminal space. And, you know, we all did that for weeks and months, but imagine that extending, you know, beyond the weeks and months into years. And when I first heard about it, I mean, a lot of these, like I mentioned, my family's from Korea, and a lot of these East Asian countries, and actually in other parts of the region as well, they were heralded really for being incredibly effective with COVID response. And so, you know, my family members, for example, they suffered similarly in terms of, you know, being forced to remain at home. But crucially, what was helpful was that because even a country like Korea is more of a social democracy than America is, and it's just also the size as well, it meant that they were always given access to food, just basic victuals and medicine. And so, you know, there's like the psychic cost of being at home, but you're not dying from, you know, the inability to get basic medicine. And that is what has been happening in China. And that is the kind of overexertion of state power that people are pushing back against.
Yeah. And describe for me, you know, having spent some time in China, what their experience of what's happening in the news is. It's obviously like a state-run media. You know, they must have a limited kind of knowledge of what's going on, and maybe there's a happy face being put on this policy, but they know it's not that happy. So what was your experience?
I mean, yes, the censorship remains difficult. Interestingly, I mean, this is a kind of an extension of censorship, but the woman that I wrote about, the movie star Fan Bingbing, she fell out of the good graces of the state and was under house arrest, is the story. You can read more about it in the magazine. But what is astonishing to me is that this happened, her kind of fall from grace and fame happened and occurred in 2018, pardon me, and she still hasn't been able to star in any movies. And so The totalizing aspect of the ways in which the state controls not just, you know, images and news and numbers, but I think the or story is kind of at times difficult to comprehend for people who haven't spent time there, maybe. And even before coming to speak with you, for example, I have a reporting background. I remain a reporter, and so I'm always curious about numbers, and they just simply don't exist. We have no idea how many people have actually died, and we have no idea how many people didn't need to die but perhaps died as a result of these draconian policies. There's just no knowing. And I think the only real and true indicator is maybe the show of anger and distress that we see on the street. That is kind of the only indicator that we have of the ways in which life has been very difficult for people for a very long time.
Well, it's interesting because there were flare-ups of protests around the country. So there obviously is some kind of like communication going on, you know, workarounds, and maybe they have enough internet access to communicate without, you know, censorship, or they're risking being surveilled by communicating, you know, hey, this is happening, let's hit the streets. This must have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, communities have always managed to, you know, figured out ways to you know, get in touch with each other. And, you know, we're not at the point of like creating, like, what are those like, samits, what are they called in Russia? Well, you know, like underground literatures or whatever.
Right.
And yeah. And I think that's what's been astonishing as well. You've alluded to this, but the fact that these protests are historically, they've often been in urban centers, which is our areas where obviously it's easier to communicate and organize, but it's been happening truly nationwide. And as well, a lot of the friends that I've been catching up with, what is astonishing is, I think, the brio, or like the, yeah, just like the unbridled courage with which people are making explicit demands that in turn specifically challenge state power. I mean, there are people in Shanghai, you've seen the videos, I'm sure, calling for, you know, Xi Jinping to step down. And that's just not something that we have seen ever before. Yeah. And again, historically, protests have always been about very specific granular issues, like my wages weren't paid, or we don't like pollution, we want the pollution to end. And these were seen as potentially kind of safe subjects that, you know, that allow people to remain in the neutral gray. Whereas I think in recent time, it's really been, you know, linked specifically to people want the party to change.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was pretty shocked to see, you know, headlines about Xi Jinping being sort of challenged. Oh, we want him to step down. That's a far cry from 2 weeks ago when it looks like he's threatening Taiwan and is like expanding his power. It's like suddenly he's under threat, or at least that's one possible, you know, aspect of this. But let's talk about what some of these protests that have stuck out for you, some of the, you know, for instance, some of the ways in which people are protesting, these blank sheets of paper that they're waving around. Let's talk, tell me about that. Like, what is the symbolism of that?
Yeah, I mean, and actually something that I want to mention as well, I'm just thinking about a lot of the images that have found their ways out to the West, I guess, is a lot of young people, young women specifically, protesting, leading marches and such. And I guess what's interesting is, because of my background, having lived in Afghanistan, obviously, I have a lot of friends who are colleagues as well, who are involved in Iran as well. And I think it's like a terrifying time, obviously. People are, real people are paying with real real lives, but equally, it does feel like an exciting time where people want change. And it feels quite easy to feel very removed and far away from these struggles. But, you know, of course, like the thing that we know to be true is that, you know, freedom and human rights, like all these sort of big ideals, our struggles are interlinked. And that's something that I explore a lot in my writing as well. Just the intersectional ways in which our struggles are linked, I think is interesting and something that maybe Americans can draw from as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was thinking about exactly that, about Iran. And, you know, the women leading a lot of the protests around that. And obviously some of that is going to bleed over into Chinese young people are also able to observe this and see this. And it gives them some sort of, you know, inspiration or backbone to think about, you know, wanting to have that kind of freedom as well. And it's always been a struggle in China, right? We've seen waves in the past of young people demanding it, and then the kind of crushing fist of the state government coming down. In this case, it's happening, right? Also, whether it can be put down entirely is unknown. I think one of the interesting things that I've observed or just read in the news is that China, as a result of these protests, has tried to change some of their policies in order to dispel it, which means that it had an impact. And as soon as the state shows that there is an impact from protesting, they've succeeded, right, on some level. Another thing I read and that I think is fascinating is that this World Cup that's going on, is that Chinese viewers of the World Cup could not help but notice that the crowds were not wearing masks, right? And so they know suddenly that the rest of the world is not having to live like this, and it's going to add more fuel to their fire, right? Tell me a little bit about about President Xi's, what are the hallmarks of his political rule over the last decade? He's consolidated power, obviously, but he's sort of, you know, in the Chinese political culture, he's pretty conservative and isolationists, right?
Yeah, I think he's taken us to places that we maybe didn't think that we would be heading. I mean, the Fan Bingbing story I did was, you know, she was in the news in many ways because she was a celebrity, and it specifically a particular kind of a celebrity, a movie star. But what happened to her is something that had happened to many members of the elites in China. And I think before this wave of people being disappeared in this way for dissent, there was a tacit kind of maybe understanding, or perhaps it was more of a hope that basically if you belong to a certain class, it will protect you. And I think Xi Jinping managed to kind of disabuse people of that notion. Mm-hmm. Really, nobody is safe. You could be at the top of your game in sports or business or, you know, in all industries and people, and from all these kind of groups, people have managed to, yeah, be punished in quite a brutal and unforgiving and punitive way. And for example, with Fan Bingbing, what was used was this thing called like residential surveillance, which is kind of the thing that kind of put her under house arrest for a very long time. It's similarly the policies that have, you know, forced, like, you know, tens of thousands and millions of Chinese people to have to remain under house arrest as well during COVID. And so in many ways, I think what has been astonishing is the totalizing ways in which he has managed to exert his state power, which has often been very violent.
Yeah. Do you think what we've seen in the last week could have a long-term impact on his grip on power? I mean, I'm skeptical reading these headlines, but that people are saying we want him to step down. Obviously, that's maybe ridiculous. He doesn't need to. Yet there's always going to be people inside his own government who are looking for an opportunity to weaken him, and this offers a little something. What's your interpretation of his political strength right now?
Right. I think journalism teaches you to sort of shy away from trying to tell the future because you're often very wrong. Yeah. But I don't know. I really am not sure. I guess the thing that makes me skeptical is the ways in which Xi Jinping and his party has managed to kind of erect infrastructure, like bureaucracy, that then, you know, gains a life of its own. It has managed, allows a kind of a surveillance state. And so, you know, one thing that I'm thinking about is like this thing that he created in 2018 called the National Supervision Commission, which effectively de facto, like, you know, gave like carte blanche to suspects being basically like kidnapped or interrogated or worse. And so, I don't know. I guess I'm always a bit suspicious of institutions' capacities to change. But I guess then again, the thing is that like we don't really know. And I think just the fervor that we've witnessed, you know, through these videos and reporting from various cities in China, I think there is good reason for people to feel at least a little bit hopeful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think one thing we can say is it won't be forgotten. And it won't be forgotten by the youth who were on the streets. And, you know, there was a little description in the New York Times of a man on the street yelling, you know, what is there to be afraid of? And people were filming him on their phones, and he was tackled by officers and shuttled into a car. So, you know, people are going to be asking, where's that guy? Right. And they have him on camera. They have him on videos. And, you know, these things we may see protests end, but the after effect will remain underground for possibly years to come. Right. Won't be forgotten in that way. But you know, the degree to which it will be metastasized into some kind of long-term counterpoint to Xi's rule, we don't know. But in any event, May, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about this. Super interesting, super enlightening. I really would urge people to go to Vanity Fair and type into your search engine, Mejong, J-E-O-N-G, and look for her stories, because they're really incredibly well done, incredibly well reported, fascinating, and will give you some insight and context around the things you're seeing in the news right now. So thank you so much, May, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.